From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Several members of Congress have been looking to restore media ownership rules ever since the June 2nd FCC decision to relax regulation. The biggest impediment, though, has been the threat of Representative Billy Tozen, a proponent of the FCC ruling, who vowed to block any efforts against it in the House. A few bills have been introduced in the Senate in the past month, but under the watchful eye of Tozen, no one, even the senators themselves, expected them to go far.
But some representatives got smart. Last week, instead of introducing a sure-to-fail bill in the Tozen-chaired Commerce Committee, they instead attached an amendment to a sure-to-pass appropriations bill. On Wednesday, that bill did indeed pass in the full House by a vote of 400 to 21. Now, amid rumors that FCC Chairman Michael Powell could step down in the fall, the prospect of restoring big media restrictions seems very likely. Joining me is Alicia Mundy, senior editor of Cable World magazine. Alicia, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, now, when we talked 3 weeks ago, you gave us your prediction of whether this legislation could ever pass. In fact, we have a clip from that conversation. All right, in one word or less, does meaningful legislation canceling out the FCC's action have the slightest chance of being passed by both houses of Congress?
No, that would be no.
Well, the House Appropriations Committee has certainly put a dent in your snowball's chance in hell theory.
I said that snowball would melt, and I have news for you. That snowball is intact. It's bigger than ever. And for those of us who cover Congress, it's exciting because it's so much fun when something completely goes amiss and nobody sees it.
Now, among those surprised by this turn of events is pretty much the entire U.S. Senate. It was in the Senate that a similar bill was introduced a month ago, but you reported that it was never even meant to pass, that everyone expected the issue to die in the House. How have the senators reacted that this is actually materializing into a genuine rebuke of the FCC?
Well, that bill in the Senate still is the kitchen sink bill, and I still think that that one cannot pass in the form that it is. What has passed in the House is a very simple part, one part of that Senate bill, which says we are not going to let the networks own more than 35% of the television stations across the United States. No one network can own more than 35%. But the senators, they kind of played around with everything, and I guess they figured, you know, it would die under its own weight. The House Appropriations people were serious, and they said, we're going to take the one part that we know that's winnable, that says big media all over it, and we're going to push this thing through. And they did.
Now, ordinarily, if this were not a rider to the entire appropriations bill, a conference committee would have to somehow reconcile the different Senate and House versions of the bill. But because it is a rider, what happens in the Senate now?
What you need is a matching Senate appropriations bill. Now that will come probably the first week of September when the senators get back. So there will probably be a matching Senate appropriations bill. And in the interim, there's one other thing hanging out there. It's called the disapproval resolution, which says we disapprove of everything the FCC did. If that goes to the Senate floor and gets enough votes to pass, it automatically goes to the House floor. Billy Tozen, once again, doesn't get a chance to get his hands on it. I mean, there's been some brilliant legislative strategy that the Democrats have put together with the help of Republicans, and it's the first time some of us who've covered Congress for years have seen some interesting Democratic moves in years.
Now, the White House notified Congress in a letter that President Bush would veto any bill that comes out of Congress overturning the FCC's actions. Now, putting aside for a moment whether the White House would veto an entire appropriations bill and stop funding the government, what are the political ramifications now that it's quite clear that there is no public support for the deregulation?
There's a law of physics that says things happen to paper. It burns and it turns to ash. And I think that letter is made out of paper right now, and I think that's what you're going to see happen to it. The White House is saying publicly, we've sent a letter, we will veto this, et cetera, et cetera. I am told, however, that at a meeting last week, Karl Rove and other people in the White House privately told the networks, there is no way we are going to veto this unless you come to us with proof that you have signatures of enough members of Congress to support our veto. We may make noise and thunder and lightning and all of that stuff, but you're not going to see a veto unless you can already produce the signatures. And here's the dilemma of the White House. If the White House vetoes it, the Democrats have a rallying cry, which even Republicans are telling me is a dangerous thing to do. If the White House doesn't veto it, it's only a 1 year's rider. It comes up for renewal when? September 30th, 2004. That's in the middle of what we call the election season. Not good.
Not to put too fine a point on it, the Bush administration at the moment is damned if it does, damned if it doesn't.
I would say instead of having a letter in their hands, they have a pickle.
All right. Well, Alicia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alicia Mundy is senior editor of Cable World, and she's with us just damn near all the time. We reported a few weeks back that the government of British Prime Minister Tony Blair was in a high noon-style showdown with the BBC. At issue, the BBC's claim that Blair's people deliberately used bad intelligence to push their Iraq war agenda. The government pressured the BBC to reveal its source. The network refused. But eventually, someone within the Blair camp revealed the name, a government scientist named David Kelly. To cut a long story short, more arguments ensued over the alleged substance of what the scientist said, and under immense pressure from both sides, the beleaguered Kelly took himself out of the picture for good. He was found dead near his home just over a week ago. Now Blair's government is facing ever more probing questions, as is the BBC. None of this turmoil is lost on commentators in the Arab press. Peter Valenti is a contributing editor for World Press Review, and he says that despite a British coroner's verdict of suicide, the inquest is ongoing in the Arab media.
Most Arab writers haven't decided whether Dr. Kelly was killed or he really did commit suicide. For example, the major Saudi paper, Sharq al-Awsat, which is published out of London, put the word suicide in quotes. Another Saudi paper, Al-Watan, uses the word murdered. Probably the harshest conspiracy theory that is promoted came out of a Jordan paper, Al-Ra'i. The author of that op-ed says Kelly was killed. And the reason he was killed was it was a message to all the others who are still working in the weapons of mass destruction field. In other words, don't open up their mouths. However, the author also hopes that this is a wake-up call for Britons because they should realize at this point that their intelligence services are, quote, playing these games behind their backs. The conclusion was that Kelly was a sacrificial lamb and that Blair himself may also be at the end of his own rope, meaning the end of his political career.
George Bush had been portrayed as the bad guy and the tool of the corporate and particularly oil interests, and Tony Blair as George Bush's lapdog. Blair has not exactly been loved in the region, but certainly wasn't as reviled as President Bush. Is Blair being more demonized in the Arab press than hitherto?
Absolutely. Great, great scorn is being heaped on Blair. We have an op-ed that came out of Lebanon in the Lebanese paper As-Safir. The title of it was Lies. It emphasizes that Blair has been a pupil of Bush. But Blair really seems to now be a caricature of the personalities that Arabs see among their own leaders in the region, meaning in the way of his lies and his methods. Another op-ed that came out of Lebanon's As-Safir said that what we're seeing in Britain, which is an echo of the United States, is a transformation into a complete insane country. The hysteria after 9/11 has led to demagoguery, that Blair has really passed the limits. And I think that some writers think that he's a step beyond what Bush has done.
Arab editorialists, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you're certainly immersed in this world, seem to me to be frequently bombastic, to say the least. How would you rate the editorials and the stories that you're seeing now for intellectual honesty?
That's a good question, actually. Some writers who have more reflective pieces actually see a good moral to this story. For example, an op-ed in the United Arab Emirates El Bayan paper says, "The Kelly incident fundamentally confirms that a free press is crucial, especially one that protects its sources." The author of this op-ed, Saeed Zahran, says, "Our respect for BBC should alert us to the fact that we need actions like this as role models for our own press, and that the Arab press needs to emulate more what the BBC has done in terms of protecting its sources and facing off against the government."
Midweek, the deaths of Saddam Hussein's sons, Qusay and Uday, seem to create a diversion, at least, for the Bush and Blair administrations. The New York Times had a headline that said that those deaths allowed, quote, a change of subject. Do you think the subject will change in the Arab press?
Overall, no. I think that the deaths of the two sons of Saddam Hussein are just a sidebar. Everyone in the Arab world knew that they were either going to be killed or captured eventually. It came as no surprise. And the focus or the attention in the Arab world is the legitimacy of the war, tying this into the controversy and debate that's happening in Washington and that's happening in London. So I don't think they'll be distracted. Even releasing the photographs of the dead sons, I think, will only be a momentary distraction.
Well, Peter, as always, many thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Valenti is contributing editor for the World Press Review, and he teaches Near Eastern Civilization at New York University.
Next up, close encounters with federal agents and what the government and media aren't telling you about dirty bombs.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In 1969, Groucho Marx told a magazine reporter that, quote, "The only hope this country has is in Nixon's assassination." Paul Krasner, the publisher of the underground magazine The Realist, heard about his friend's comment and impishly dashed off a letter to the Justice Department. The feds had recently arrested Black Panther leader David Hilliard for threatening Nixon during a speech, and Krasner wanted to know what the government was going to do about Groucho. The U.S. attorney responded that Groucho's remarks did not constitute a true threat because he was an alleged comedian and not the leader of an organization which advocates killing people and overthrowing the government.
That was then, and this is now. No longer, it seems, can those around the president, well, take a joke. On Monday, the truth was driven home from Michael Ramirez, an editorial cartoonist at the Los Angeles Times. His cartoon from the previous day portrayed President Bush with a gun to his head, and it caught the attention of the Secret Service. Michael, welcome to OTM.
Well, thanks.
So tell me about the cartoon that you drew.
Well, the cartoon was a rehash of a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo from 1968. Showing the South Vietnamese police chief Lone executing a VC spy. And I thought it was appropriate because I was drawing a parallel between the politicization of the Vietnam War and the current politicization that's surrounding the Iraq War related to the Niger uranium story.
Now, the cartoon is set in a street in Iraq, and the key detail here is that the executioner character, which is labeled Politics, is holding a gun to the head of President Bush.
Right. Metaphorically, I was saying that there are people currently engaged in the political assassination of our president. And so the cartoon is really just a literal interpretation of that metaphor.
And so the cartoon ran in last Sunday's paper.
Right.
What happened when you got into work on Monday?
Well, John Ashcroft was sitting in my office. Now I have to screen all my cartoons through him.
No, really?
Oh, really? Well, you know, it was kind of strange. The firestorm began actually with Matt Drudge's report on Sunday evening, which was a little interesting because he had the headline on his report that said that I was being investigated by the Secret Service. And I really wasn't contacted by the Secret Service until the next morning at 10:30.
Well, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Sounds like he has a line into the Secret Service.
I think Matt Drudge is with the Secret Service.
Tell me your reaction when you heard that the Secret Service was interested in speaking to you.
Well, you know, I got this call from this gentleman, and actually it was very nice, but it was so casual and laid back. I really assumed it was a crank call. He said, I'd like to meet with you somewhere and talk to you. I'm with the Secret Service. And I said, well, yeah, well, you can meet me here at the paper. How do I know you're with the Secret Service? And he said, well, I've got a black suit and black sunglasses and credentials. And so I was kind of laughing about it. And I said, well, sure, come on down and make sure you bring your credentials. And, you know, sure enough, half an hour later, security called my editor and said the Secret Service is here. And at that point, because of precedence and the freedom of the press, legal counsel intervened. So I didn't actually speak to him except for when he initially called me.
Now, threatening the president is against federal law, and it's the Secret Service's job to protect the president against potential threats. Do you think that Bush's security detail should have felt threatened by your cartoon?
No, I think this is a pretty famous image, and I think the use is a metaphor, especially in light of the fact that it really is a cartoon that favors him and his administration.
Come on, even if it hadn't. I mean, you've been drawing cartoons for 19 years. Have any of your cartoons ever attracted this much attention?
Well, you know, I have a tendency to drive the cartoons to the edge of the envelope, and I've never been investigated by the Secret Service. But you know what? Cartoons have to be controversial. I mean, we want a forum that will be the catalyst for thought. So we use whatever device we can, and any sort of intimidation that goes on is not a good thing.
Now, the Secret Service says that the inquiry was routine, but do you think there's any chance that this would have happened 10 or 20 years ago or 5 years ago or even 3 years ago?
Sure. I think 9/11 really has heightened our sense of awareness concerning everything. Clearly, they used a bad judgment in this circumstance. In fact, it makes me wonder about the intelligence and our intelligence services.
So are you planning any cartoons about the Secret Service?
Well, Brooke, as a matter of fact, I am. I'm going to be doing a cartoon where I take the exact same image that caused this controversy, and I'm replacing the South Vietnamese police chief with a gigantic howitzer labeled Secret Service, and I'm going to have me instead of the president, and I have a thought bubble which reads, overreacting a little bit, aren't you?
Michael Ramirez, thank you very much.
Brooke, thanks for having me on.
Michael Ramirez is an editorial cartoonist for the Los Angeles Times. Unlike Ramirez, freelancer Mark Schultz had no paper to protect him. And when the FBI came a call in last month, he talked. Mark Schultz wrote about his encounter with the FBI for creativeloafing.com. He says it all began with a call from Mom.
My mom calls up and she says, now you're not in trouble, but the FBI is here and they want to speak to you. She wanted to know if they could come to my work and talk to me, and so I thought, sure, why not? They showed up, and I had assumed that someone I knew had gotten some government work, and they were doing a background check, and they started asking me about what kind of car do you drive, And that's when it dawned on me that they're here to talk to me. They started asking me about Saturday, the Saturday before. They wanted to know if I had been in this coffee shop and if I had brought anything in with me. And I had no idea. You know, I go in this coffee shop 4 or 5 times a week. So I said, yeah, probably I was in there. And I probably brought in my sunglasses and my cell phone. And that was not what they wanted. Eventually, they leveled with me. They said, what we're really here for is someone in the coffee shop saw you reading something, a printout of some kind, and it looked suspicious enough to them that they decided to call us. And so that's what we're here to find out about.
And you were racking your brain to figure out what it was that might have set off suspicions in somebody else. And you actually couldn't remember until later in the evening, right?
That's right. I figured it was some kind of left-wing piece because I read 1,000 of those things a week. It turned out it was a media criticism by Hal Crowther called Weapons of Mass Stupidity about Rupert Murdoch and Fox News and how they're lowering the bar for media coverage in this country.
Now, when you realized that it was this article called Weapons of Mass Stupidity and that this somehow brought the FBI to your door, how did you take that?
Well, I take it as being a slight, I guess, against my appearance. I've got a beard, and I feel like I must have been profiled.
Profiled as a Jewish lefty with a beard?
Yeah, well, I live in Cobb County, Newt Gingrich country, and it's quite possible someone took a look at me, saw my beard, decided this guy must be some kind of an Arab. On the other hand, it could be someone who's a big fan of Fox News.
But the point is that it seemed to have been enough to induce the FBI to look you up.
Well, that's the bizarre part, that whoever this was called up and said, well, I'd like to report some reading. And the FBI said, reading, We better send some guys to check this out.
Well, an FBI agent named Paris was quoted in an article as saying, I've explained so many times, I can't specifically comment on this particular case, but anytime a citizen calls up with a suspicion of terrorist activity, we have no choice to follow up on it. We have to err on the side of talking to too many people, because God help us if we don't talk to the next Muhammad Atta. So, do you think that's fair?
I certainly see their side of it. They're under such constant fire for potential past mistakes. The question I have is, can anyone really call up and report anyone they want? It seems like there should be some kind of quality control on these tips. You know, any jerk with a cell phone can call in someone who cuts them off in traffic or looks at them funny. I read some quotes from Paris saying that the FBI does not investigate people to find out what they read, and to portray them that way is a disservice to the organization and the country. But that's how they presented themselves to me. What they said, in fact, was, there's no problem. We just need to get to the bottom of this, find out what you were reading. And if we can't do that, then you might have a problem, and you don't want that.
What if you were reading, instead of Weapons of Mass Stupidity about Fox News and Rupert Murdoch, you were reading An Easy Guide to Creating Weapons of Mass Destruction?
In that case, maybe someone should check it out, but I don't know what kind of a terrorist would be, well, standing in line at a coffee shop reading instructions on how to be a terrorist.
That's true. Well, Mark, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Mark Schultz is a freelance writer, soon to be a journalism grad student, and he spoke to us from WABE in Atlanta.
To many experts, the dirty bomb is the most overrated weapon in the terrorist arsenal. That's because the actual loss of life and property from such an attack probably would be relatively limited. But the specter of even a small amount of radiation in the air would likely cause great panic both during the attack and long afterwards. That is, unless Americans are prepared in advance on how to react. So why has the White House done so little to educate the public about dirty bombs, or for that matter, any potential terrorist threat? And why hasn't the press challenged government officials on this lapse, nor try to fill the gap themselves? On the Media's John Solomon explains.
WTOP News Time, 8:31.
This just in to the WTOP Newsroom.
We are getting reports of an explosion near the Van Ness Metro Station. The Connecticut Avenue entrance reportedly is caved in. Now, we have a reporter heading to the scene now, and we will give you more details as they become...
The bad news, the explosion turned out to be a terrorist bomb laced with plutonium. The good news, this was an excerpt from a mock radio cast produced last month for a National Academy of Engineering workshop to see how government officials and journalists would handle a dirty bomb attack. The most important news is what they found out from the exercise.
I think that we're ill-prepared.
National Academy official Randy Atkins organized the simulation.
It was pretty clear that there was a lot of confusion about, for example, simple buzzwords that are probably going to create panic in the public. Nuclear, radiological, what's potassium iodide, plutonium.
Atkins says that many of those engaged in the exercise had trouble explaining the difference between a dirty bomb and a full-scale nuclear device. A local weatherman there mistakenly warned that a plume of radiation would spread, imperiling the whole region.
These are all things that are going to cause people near the incident to panic. It's going to cause traffic jams. It's going to cause delays in getting first responders to the scene. It's going to cause people to pull back from victims that really need help. It's going to cause people to run when perhaps they should stay in place.
The Bush administration has long understood the need to address this scenario with the public and the media. In March of 2002, the Center for Strategic and International Studies held a similar exercise. This time the dirty bomb exploded on the Washington Mall, with top U.S. Homeland Security officials in attendance. As one later told Stephen Brill for his book, After, How America Confronted the September 12th Era, we know we have to deal with this sooner or later. More than a year later, they still haven't. Even though Brill says officials told him that they would be surprised if that type of an attack doesn't happen here in the near future.
I don't think they've treated it like the urgent threat that it is. The whole idea ought to be to just take that weapon out of the arsenal of the terrorists. And this is one situation where you can take the weapon away without spending money, without shooting people, and without 2 years of planning. If I were Tom Ridge and George Bush, I'd ask for a half hour of network time to hold a teach-in about dirty bombs. The time to give that speech is now, not 2 hours after someone sets off one of these bombs and everybody's panicked, because it's not going to work then.
In the almost 2 years since the September 11th attacks, President Bush has never addressed the country on dirty bombs, nor for that matter any civil defense issue. Veteran Wall Street Journal reporter Cynthia Crossan, author of Tainted Truth, The Manipulation of Fact in America, suggests there may be a political motive.
They like the idea that they can say the words dirty bomb and send people into a panic, that there's a certain kind of power. If you have people fearful about their lives and the possibility of an attack, it makes it easier to advance an agenda, a political agenda, which is less privacy and more government control and observation of its citizens.
Stephen Brill attributes better, if short-sighted, intentions to the government.
I suspect that the thinking in the White House is, well, gee, we don't want to scare people. And there's something to that. But the fact is that the cost of scaring people a little bit today compared to the cost of people being, ignorant and panicked when something happens, that's an easy decision.
But this less is more approach may be misjudging the public. A Carnegie Mellon University paper to be released later this year found that 8 of 10 Americans want the government to provide them honest, accurate information about terrorism, even if it is worrisome. Brill says the press isn't serving the public well either.
We can blame the government for this, but everyone in the media should blame themselves. I mean, there's nothing stopping, NBC from doing a special on how to deal with this stuff, except the fact that they won't get the same ratings as they get from, a show ironically called Fear Factor.
Cynthia Crossan is puzzled by the lack of coverage. Maybe, she surmises, it's just the sheer magnitude and mystery of the possibilities.
Nobody has ever hijacked planes and flown them into big buildings before. That was beyond our imagination. And now I think there's some sense, too, that whatever's going to come next, it's not something that we're even thinking about. So it does put both the government and the media in a bind to try to go through, okay, here's what to do with a dirty bomb, here's what to do with, all the while knowing that that is a little bit of grasping straws.
The National Academy's Randy Atkins organized last month's workshop in large part to help the media understand and communicate these complex and unfamiliar topics.
We need to challenge journalists to find ways of making this material interesting. It is science. It is engineering. I think that it sometimes is difficult to get the public engaged in it. And I think it's almost more difficult sometimes to get journalists engaged in it. I see journalists as people that to a large extent probably went to journalism school to do things other than science and engineering, and they're certainly not going to go out of their way to report on these sort of issues now.
But with the government quiet, if the press doesn't go out of its way, the public may not know where it should go and what it should do in the event something does happen. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
We haven't read your letters on the show for a while, so here's a sampling. Alexander Ott of Little Neck, New York, was, quote, disappointed with the lead story you did on the BBC. The story focused initially on the conflict between the BBC and the British government regarding the weapons of mass destruction issue. It later broadened to address the BBC's allegedly changing reporting style from objective and dispassionate to more politicized and sensational. Unfortunately, listeners of On the Media didn't have an opportunity to hear an opposing opinion on these topics and decide for themselves. And Chris Conley of Seattle adds, I only wish, how I wish, that NPR had the guts and energy the BBC does. But thank you for reporting on the controversy.
Our interview with Tom Mabe, who's built a recording career taping his torturous conversations with telemarketers, prompted this from Rob English of Syracuse, New York. Quote, that mean-spirited prankster needs to realize that most telemarketers are decent human beings who are working in a difficult job for low pay, unlike the owners and bosses at the telemarketing companies who make all the money and all the decisions about whom to call and when.
Finally, on our parody of reporters who stop at nothing to book an interview with an accused murderer, John Ebert of Hickory, North Carolina, declared that, quote, the segment today about Scott Peterson and the answering machine was one of the worst, most tasteless pieces ever written. Shame.
Don't sugarcoat your comments. Just keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, the rise of mob blogging and we journalism, plus a nation's passion for people trapped in holes.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Tuesday night, a mob of about 65 people marched into the Mall of America in Minneapolis and proceeded to strike robot-like poses in front of a giant plasma screen showing The Lord of the Rings. The participants were summoned via email or text messaging. This event and others like it in New York and San Francisco are testaments to the organizational potential of new communications technology. This sort of spontaneous happening has been dubbed a flash mob, part of the smart mob phenomenon that Howard Rheingold laid out in his prophetic book, Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution. And he says it's evolving past performance art to forever alter the way we gather and disseminate information vital to our lives. Howard Rheingold, welcome to On the Media.
My pleasure to be here.
So the first international mob logging conference happened this month in Tokyo. What does this conference signify for you?
Well, it was gratifying for me because I predicted in the book, not really a difficult prediction, that people were going to start sending pictures and commentary about events they witnessed in the world directly to the internet from their telephones. Because we now have these picture phones, camera phones, and in some parts of the world, like Tokyo, you can actually send video to the net. And I think that that's a radical new way for news to be disseminated. I think it's one of the many changes that the combination of the internet as a distribution medium and the mobile device as a production medium is bringing us.
I wonder if you can give me a couple of examples of mob logging and an important news event. Has that happened yet?
You know, we have not seen the really seminal news event mob logged yet. We haven't seen something that's really something that you would see on the front pages that comes from someone on the street before it comes from one of the mass media. But I think one event that was something of a watershed was when the worldwide anti-war demonstrations happened before the U.S. attack on Iraq. The BBC in London had a website where they invited people all over the world who had camera phones that were equipped to send messages to the internet, to send them photographs from the demonstrations. So you could log on to the internet from anywhere in the world that day and see on the BBC site photographs from demonstrations in Stockholm and Berlin and San Francisco. I think really for the first time in history, the people who were participating in the events were the ones who were sending the images that people saw in the world.
A lot has been said about the democratization of the media through all of these new technologies, but 7 or 8 years back, I interviewed Matt Drudge, who told me, let a million journalists report. And let's face it, he's not an ideal poster child for this sort of unmediated journalism.
Matt Drudge is a good example of the fact that democratization does not necessarily equal higher quality. Yes, we will see a million journalists bloom, and many of them are going to be sensational or wrong. Some of them are going to be as good as anything you're going to see, and I think eventually we'll be winning those Pulitzer Prizes. Dan Gilmore at the San Jose Mercury, the paper of record for the Silicon Valley, has a weblog that is very high quality. Over time, reputations, I think, are going to distinguish the people who use good journalistic techniques from those who are merely sensational reporters.
So your book is called Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution. Is it still next, or has it arrived?
The smart mob revolution is really just beginning. I think if you remember what happened with personal computers and with the internet, that will give you an idea of where we are now. In the early 1980s, the personal computer came along, and a lot of people asked, what the heck are we going to do with these things? We now know what you can do with these things. I think we're about at the same point with smart mobs now. The combination of the mobile telephone, the internet, and the personal computer is making a new medium possible. We're seeing Philippine citizens peacefully overthrowing a government. They organized that through text messaging, and that was not the elite. The mobile telephone in the Philippines was the poor person's internet. We are seeing the Howard Dean campaign using self-organization. We're seeing these flash crowds doing kind of performance art on the street. These are really just the first manifestations. Where it's going to lead, I think, is going to be very much more powerful than either the PC or the internet, because we're talking about people mobilizing collective action. And mobilizing collective actions of what civilization has been about.
So the revolution this time will be televised.
It will be webcast.
Howard Rheingold, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Howard Rheingold joined me from his home outside San Francisco. His book is Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution, and his website is Rheingold.com. We're joined now by the blogger and professional journalist he mentioned, Dan Gilmore. Gilmore is making a study of the relationship between professional journalists and those who are driven through conviction or mischief or whatever to report from their PCs and cell phone cameras to the world. He says their efforts are already seeping into the mainstream and that someday their work will be part of all of our media diets. Dan, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
So you are a technology columnist for the Mercury News, as well as a blogger. You're also a proponent of what I guess you've termed we journalism. How do you define that?
Well, I define it in basically one way, which is the notion that my readers know more than I do. And I'd like to capture that knowledge in the best sense of the word for our mutual advantage. I like to have them as part of a conversation.
And not just a casual conversation, I guess, because you're working on a book called Making the News. You have the outline on the web. It's fascinating, by the way. You're asking readers to participate in every single chapter. Tell me what Making the News is about.
It's about this intersection of journalism and technology and what happens to journalism in the largest sense of the word as a result. You have, I think, three constituencies, one being, of course, the journalists, but you also have the people we call newsmakers, the people and institutions we write about. And then finally, you have what I've been calling the former audience, and I say former because I think they're now part of the process if they want to be.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind speculating about the great opportunity that web journalists have ahead of them in the upcoming election.
I'm intrigued beyond belief at what Howard Dean is doing with the web. I think there's a breakthrough going on there, but I have to do a lot more reporting before I'm sure I understand exactly what it is. But they have this fundamental belief in the Dean campaign that the decentralized nature of the internet is going to work for them in a very big way. And I think that we're going to see journalists popping up following individual campaigns or individual subjects. And they may be total amateur webloggers or professionals, but who want to drill in some niche part of the process and bring us more than we ever wanted to know in some cases about some angle on the thing. I think that's where the real value of weblogs shows up, and I hope we see a lot of that.
With regard to the many, many bloggers who may be covering the election, there's an interesting chapter title in the book that you put online, or the outline, called Can We Believe Any of This?
Well, the answer is yes, we can believe some of it. One of the things webloggers do is kind of fact-check each other. Ken Lane, who's a wonderful weblogger and newspaper guy, wrote, "We can fact-check your ass." I thought that was a great line, and it was very true. And it's important that people correct the things they get wrong. But if they don't, they lose credibility among the people who will otherwise point at them. We do need to recalibrate at some level our sense of skepticism, because any web page can look as good as any other web page and look as authoritative. The audience is going to have to actually start thinking a little bit the way reporters think, which is to remember that just because they saw it somewhere doesn't mean it's true.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be with you.
Journalist, author, and blogger Dan Gilmore's website can be found at siliconvalley.com. He spoke to us from Stanford University.
Monday at midnight marks the first anniversary of the triumphant moment when nine men were hoisted from what seemed likely to be their grave in a flooded Pennsylvania mine. The tale of the Cue Creek miners inspired a media frenzy that eventually took its toll on some of the rescued and their rescuers alike. It can be hard to predict which events will dominate the airwaves in the nation's imagination, but history tells us that the public will always respond to stories about people trapped in holes. Mike Pesca looks back on the dramatic history of this most literal variety of underground journalism.
A safety expert from the United Mine Workers Union called the Cue Creek rescue unprecedented in modern times. Miraculous? Yes. Unprecedented? Decidedly not. man or men or sometimes babies trapped underground has been a story for as long as people have been telling stories, or at least selling them in newspapers or broadcasting them. There was the case of Floyd Collins.
You never heard of Floyd Collins?
That's Kirk Douglas in the 1951 movie Ace in the Hole. He plays a journalist who stumbles across a man trapped in a cave. Here he reminds a Cub reporter about a similar story.
Floyd Collins, doesn't that ring a bell?
No, not to me, it doesn't.
1925, Kentucky? The guy pinned way down in that cave? One of the biggest stories that ever broke. Front page in every paper in the country for weeks.
Maybe I did hear about it.
Maybe you heard that a reporter on the Louisville paper crawled in for the story and came out with a Pulitzer Prize.
It's true. The 1926 Pulitzer Prize for reporting was awarded to William Burke Miller of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Miller, known as Skeets, became a character in the 1995 musical Floyd Collins, which dealt with the drama in the cave and the chaos in the newsroom.
K City, comma, capital K, capital Y, February 4. K victim losing hope.
According to Skeets Miller, comma, Collins is quickly slipping into a state of deep despair.
Asking for milk.
The trapped man was heard to cry out, folks, get me out of here, comma, even if you have to tear my foot off. Exclamation, close quote.
Floyd is reported to be in a state of delirium, conversing with the cave crickets and even begging them to hurry, 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 call me out.
A little more than a decade after Floyd Collins, reporter J. Frank Willis of the Canadian Radio Commission covered the collapse of the Moose River Mine in Nova Scotia, Canada.
It is a broken country down here, drab and desolate. A country of scrub and second growth, of rock. Rock, relentless, hard, cruel hard. It is against rock of this sort that miners for the past week have fought and fought, grim-lipped, determined, and they're winning their fight. Inch by inch, the rock is retreating.
Today, news networks never leave these stories. Even if little is happening on the scene, time will be filled with talking heads, recovery experts, and, in the absence of that, speculation. Willis, however, was fiercely committed to the notion that only that which was newsworthy should be broadcast.
As a rumor has gone abroad and has been published as a fact that the mine is in danger of caving in, this is absolutely not true. We're standing here, we can spit into this pit, and yet, from thousands of miles away, people are contradicting what we have to say. This must stop. I'm stopping these broadcasts now until something definite happens.
One man died, two survived. The Moose River cave-in was one of the first times that radio displayed its power to connect with listeners on a real-life event occurring in real time. A decade later, TV would demonstrate that ability in its coverage of yet another person trapped in a hole. In 1949, 3-year-old Kathy Fiscus fell into a well near Los Angeles. Local station KTLA's round-the-clock coverage was groundbreaking in that it proved TV could find ample drama outside the scripted world of the studio. In fact, it was a KTLA reporter who informed her family that Kathy had died. Her grave marker reads, "A little girl who brought the world together for a moment." Almost 40 years later, there was another moment. Another little girl was trapped in a well. Jessica McClure. Mary Alice Williams was one of CNN's primary anchors in 1987.
We were the only ones on the air when this 18-month-old baby girl fell into a well. And suddenly, all the huge international stories melted away. Of course, many, many hours later, the broadcast networks caught on to the drama of this event.
We were still rather looked down on by the other networks. They didn't consider us to be equals.
Bob Fernad was CNN's vice president and senior producer during the Jessica McClure rescue.
Our ratings shot up as people left the three broadcast networks, assuming correctly so that they do the story and then go back to their regular programming and that we'd stay with it. And our ratings spiked, and for the first time, we beat the three broadcast networks in eyeballs.
And that's what made the Jessica McClure story a watershed for CNN. It confirmed what was an operating theory, that this new way of covering a story, wall to wall, was the formula for success. However, former anchor Mary Alice Williams thinks cable news took the wrong lesson from the little girl in the well.
What it led to was the wall-to-wall coverage of O.J. Simpson. And the motive for watching O.J. was pure prurience. There was no other reason. it was a collective schadenfreude. Look how the mighty have fallen. Baby Jessica wasn't that. It was the opposite. It was a collective hope, a collective prayer to save a person's life, a baby's life.
Such is the fine line in TV news between pathos and bathos, between bathos and exploitation. It's not a happily ever after story for the rest of the Jessica McClure participants either. Jessica herself still lives in Texas, plays the French horn, and makes A's and B's in school. She has a trust fund in excess of $1 million. The only interview she does is with Ladies Home Journal, which recently revealed that Jessica has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Her parents, teenagers at the time, divorced. Her rescuer, Robert O'Donnell, couldn't handle the stress of having been a hero in the world's eyes, only to see the spotlight snatched away so quickly. He bored co-workers with endless stories of his time in the hole, squabbled with fellow rescuers over payment for the TV movie, developed a dependence on prescription painkillers, and in 1995 took his own life with a shotgun blast to the head. Perhaps most interesting is what happened to Skeets Miller, who interviewed Floyd Collins in 1925. He left Louisville soon after he won his Pulitzer and moved to radio. By 1947, he was at NBC, where he served as assignment editor for the company's newest venture, television. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Oh, come all you young people and listen while I tell the fate of Floyd Collins, the lad we all knew well. His face was fair and handsome.
As for the stars in the drama at Q Creek, Robert Long, the brash rescuer credited with directing the drill that saved the miners, last month shot himself in the head. The miners themselves are variously beset with jealousy and fear, flashbacks and unemployment. Only one of them, Randy Fogle, returned to the Q Creek mine, where he earns about $15 an hour.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Sean Landis, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball, Blake Carlton, and Josh Keating. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Carfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.